Welcome to the Pro Cheerleading Podcast. This is the only podcast that gives you a raw and unfiltered perspective of what it's really like to be a professional cheerleader. Whether you're currently on a pro team, an alumni, or really curious about what it takes to become a pro cheerleader, the Pro Cheerleading Podcast gives you all the inside scoop and hot topics in the pro cheerleading industry and in-depth interviews of current and former cheerleaders. I'm your host, Makiba. Join me every Wednesday as I reveal the truth behind the palms. Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You are like my Carrie Bradshaw. I hope you know this.
Stop.
You give of the vibes. I just like am living vicariously through you. Your career, I cannot wait to get into. Like, I'm just so proud of you. And
well, I feel like we've been walking hand in hand throughout this whole journey of mine. You know, like you are my I always told you this, like you're my go-to expert because doing this research and talking to the dancers for so long. And so like, you know, you've always had your finger on the pulse of what's actually going on. And I'm like, send help. How does Makiba feel about this? Because that's what I need to know.
I tried. I actually had to like look back at when it actually began, because I feel like I've known you forever. And I know we haven't, but we were just finishing up your piece on Lindsay Rosenberg. And like when I like went all the way to the beginning of our Instagram chat, I was like, that's when it happened.
That was
like,
that
was the first time that we had connected, because you had mentioned that you were working on it. And then we just went on a Lindsay Love Fest. You know how we just both love her so much. But yeah, so many amazing things have happened since then. So we have been on this journey together. I know that seemed like just yesterday, frankly, but it's been a long way.
We're so, like trauma bonded, you know?
Forever.
Literally.
Which is why I have my rosé, even though I probably will just be too excited to drink from it. But
can I grab a glass of wine then?
Oh yeah, you can.
I can toast you. Hold on one sec. Okay. Got it.
Oh yes. I love it.
Hey, cheers.
Cheers to you. Yes, yes, yes. Let's just go ahead and kick off this episode. I just toasted to, now I'm going to drink, the Carrie Bradshaw of professional cheer and dance. This is Emily Liebert, everybody, former NFL cheerleader, amazing journalist who just graduated with her master's in journalism from New York University. So proud of you. That is why we are toasting today, because not only has she been in school for like the past year and a half, she's also been writing her butt off for Jezebel, for Teen Vogue, for Refinery 29 and more, and just covering this space, which we have so much to talk about. And I just welcome you to the podcast officially. I feel like we're besties from way back when, just connecting on a lot of the issues and stuff going on in our world. So welcome to the show. Finally, we are meeting. I'm so excited.
Yes, thank you. Long time listener, first time caller.
This is long overdue. So I'm just excited to have you, and I'm obsessed with your career in journalism. I think you can tell already. So I would love to start there, but we're going to start with your cheerleading connection, obviously, because you are a talented performer and work in the NFL again for 3 seasons. And so I want to hear about your journey in dance. And then I promise not to hog the whole interview with your career in journalism, but talk to me about how you got started, what made you want to become an NFL cheerleader, and all of the things.
Okay. I'll try not to make this a super long story, because it started when I was 3 years old, as dancer stories start. I just used to dance around the house all the time. My mom would always play Paula Abdul, and my sister and I would just like shimmy around the living room naked. And my mom's like, you guys need an outlet. We got to get you out of the house. So she put me in ballet classes, and I fell in love, and I ended up spending the next 15 years at the dance studio. Every waking moment when I wasn't in school, I was, you know, in rehearsals, doing ballet, tap, jazz, contemporary, pretty much everything except hip hop, which I was not very good at, but learned to love later on.
Okay. And where's home for you, Emily?
Moorpark, California. So it's about an hour north of LA.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were doing the whole kind of studio dance and competitive dance and all of that in the California area?
Yeah. And then I had this moment where I had to figure out if I wanted to go to school for either writing or communications, or if I wanted to go to school for dance. And I tried out at a bunch of different programs, got into a few, and ultimately made the decision that I loved and adored dance so much. But I thought at that point I wanted to keep it as something for me. And I was like, I'm gonna let this kind of take the backseat to my career. I should pick something that's seems really professional and maybe I'll make some money. You know, 18-year-old trying to make life choices, which is crazy.
Isn't that just crazy? I mean, what do we know at 18? It's
Yeah,
crazy.
so I ultimately decided that I would kind of do dance as more of an extracurricular, as my passion, and work towards something else professionally. And I went to USC. I actually got into the journalism program there. And in my very first journalism class, the professor, he was like kind of an older guy. And he was like, I just want to let you know right now, you're not going to make any money in this career. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm out. Like, it was just this like
Wow.
very quick decision of like, you know, eldest daughter syndrome. Like, I feel like I have to carry on the legacy and make sure that we can, you know, keep generational wealth and financial health going. And so we'll get to that part later. But I just danced on the side. I joined a couple of campus groups and I had zero cheerleading experience. I was always a dancer. And in high school, you know, very rudely, we had this kind of rivalry, whether they know it or not, with the cheer team, you know, and we were like, well, they do stunts and stuff, but like, you know, they don't dance. They're, you know, it's funny because like we obviously will talk a lot about the culture that surrounds cheerleading, but even from dancers who have somewhat similar skills and a similar kind of performance quality, even we were kind of devaluing and belittling what they did, which is ironic.
For NBA dancers, sometimes we're not wanting to be called cheerleaders because of that distinction. So there's still a little bit of that going on.
Yeah, and also with like commercial industry or kind of like the rep professional companies, ballet, like there's definitely a little bit of that looking down their noses at the pro cheer and pro dance world. So it's just kind of all of these layers within. Yeah, I definitely fed into that. And then I had a roommate freshman year who I met online in one of those housing portals. And we both connected because we love dance. I was like, okay, this is going to make a great roommate. And I believe her mom or dad had gone to USC and she had wanted to be a USC song girl her whole life. And she tells me this, and I'm like, I don't know what that is. Like, no one in my family went to USC. Like, we don't have any cheerleaders in the family. And basically, for those who don't know, the song girls are kind of this like storied tradition at USC. They wear the white sweaters, very kind of like classic old school collegiate look. And there's only usually between 9 and 13 on the squad every year. So it's like a very small
That's
number.
small. Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay.
So they always used to say it's very exclusive. And obviously,
Interesting.
I don't even know who you guys are, but yeah. And then I saw them on the sidelines during my freshman year watching football games, and I was like, oh wow, that is so freaking cool. Like, you get to be right there in the action. So I tried out and I had no idea what I was getting into. Never held a pom-pom in my life. And ultimately that made me more confident because I thankfully didn't realize what a big deal it was at the time, or at least on the USC campus, to be a part of that group. So I kind of just walked in like blissfully ignorant and was like, well, I'm just gonna dance my butt off and smile and hope it works out. And it did. So that was really my first foray into cheerleading. And that team is interesting because the choreographic style has changed a bit since then. But at the time, it really was just dancing while holding pom-poms.
Got it. Okay.
It broke down a lot of stereotypes that I kind of had held on to about what cheerleading was. Like, I thought it was just the spelling out and the yelling and holding little cones,
Right.
Yeah. Literal rah-rah. And I was like, oh, wow. Like everyone on this team is a really talented dancer who just happens to hold pom-poms. And the reason that we hold pom-poms is because we're performing for a stadium of, you know, 70,000 people. So that was just kind of our like, hey, I'm here. Look at us. So yeah, that was, you know, just for fun. I didn't have any plans of doing anything with cheer or dance professionally at that point. And after I graduated from school, you know, I was in the working world. I think 3 years later, I just kind of was bored and I missed
it. Study.
I dropped out of journalism and then picked up a PR major.
Got it. Okay.
Still communications heavy, still writing heavy, but it was in service of, you know, corporations or different brands or, you know, TV shows. So it was writing, but for a different audience and more of like a, from a sales perspective, I guess. So yeah.
Okay, started to build it. I was trying to like see good. Where you ended up going.
I know it. My path is quite windy.
Like, that's the beauty of life though. It's never really like, boom, straight ahead. This is where I'm going. This is what I'm doing. It's like, but then sometimes you just wind up back where you kind of were planning to be all along. It just takes a different path of getting there. So.
Right. It's kind of like the journey of trying to be what you thought you're supposed to be and then winding up at the self you always were, which is kind of like a little aha moment.
You deep over there. I like it though.
I've thought about it a lot because I always wondered, you know, when I was in PR, I always wondered if I had made a mistake. I still loved writing. It was always kind of like my first love, even before dance. I would tell stories to my mom, you know, even when I could hardly talk, she always said I would open a book and just start babbling at her. Like I was pretending to read and like telling her a story. So it's always been in my bones. And I just, you know, I was like, I feel like I have this thing, this one thing that I know that I'm really good at. And I wasn't using it at all. Not in my personal life, not in my professional life. And so to finally wind back up in this place of writing where writing is guiding my career was really, really exciting. So I've always looked back thinking like, did I waste time? Did I make a mistake? And ultimately, I think that the way things worked out really worked in my favor because even though I entered the field, meaning the media industry at a later age, I think I was 27, 28, I was coming in with a different life experience. Right? Like, yeah. Anyways, we'll get to that. So yeah, I basically was just bored. And a dear friend of mine who remains one of my best friends to this day, Sammy Olson. Hi, Sammy. She had been on Trojan Dance Force, which was also at USC. And that was a bit more modeled after NBA dancing.
Okay.
She had done the very first year of LA Rams cheer when they first moved to LA. And I was like, wow, she looks beautiful. She looks like she's having so much fun. And all the while she was still working a corporate job and just kind of doing this on nights and weekends. And I was like, that sounds amazing. I still want to be able to, you know, work my 9 to 5, but I just need a little extra like spice in my life. I just, you know, I need to live a little bit. And like, I miss the feeling of like being in a rehearsal room and goofing around with a bunch of your friends. So very, very similar to basically what had happened with Song, where I certainly prepared far more. I had to get back into my splits because I hadn't taken a dance class in a while. I was like, we got to work on this flexibility, babe. Yeah. So I took a bunch of, you know, just straight jazz classes. I was stretching while I watched my Real Housewives, and I had a little custom outfit made and I tried to mimic, you know, the red lipstick and the bling everywhere. And ultimately it worked out. And I still maintain to this day that, you know, I was never under any impression that I was the best dancer in the room, but I knew that I was passionate. I knew that I could perform. And I also knew that I had, you know, this other life outside of dance that made me a good spokesperson, because at the end of the day, you are a spokesperson for the brand. The brand just happens to be this massive organization that is a football team.
I like that you use spokesperson. I like that even better than ambassador, because it's very clear that you will be put in situations where you are speaking on behalf, acting on behalf, and to some extent of an organization. And it holds a little bit more, not power, but I like the way that sounds, a little bit better than ambassador. I think it's clear in terms of like the purpose and role. You're not just like a goodwill ambassador. It makes you almost think like waving hello and greeting everyone, as opposed to like taking a more active role that you're sometimes thrown into, acting on behalf of the organization. So I like that term.
Well, I think because, you know, we would often line the entrance to some branded party or event or sponsorship gala or something like that. And, you know, you would do the classic shoulders moving, shaking the pom-poms, saying hello to everyone. But then we would go inside and we would speak to very important people, very important donors, season ticket holders, all of these people where, you know, for the Rams, it was so important for them to not only keep those relationships alive, but strengthen them. And when you're in a very intimate situation where you're having these one-on-one or two-on-one conversations, I mean, they're going to come into that conversation with some preconceived notions, whether they adore you or they've never seen you on the field before.
What's
And
like wearing here? Sometimes there's that little Frosty the Snowman kind of effect where they're not
exactly.
really appreciating that you're there for a purpose and that you can actually engage with them in conversation. So
Right.
there's that dynamic too. Yeah.
And even when, you know, if somebody's not filming you or you're not doing this for media, those people are then going to go off and tell their friends, oh, I met an LA Rams cheerleader. And, you know, the two that I spoke with were actually really smart. And it just takes that one conversation to start, like, kind of, what is the word? Like, spreading the roots. And that's a horrible imagery. But, you know, like, that sets off a chain reaction.
For sure.
I heard the cheerleaders are actually really cool and smart, right? Which shouldn't be surprising. And we in this community know that that's obviously the rule. We're all cool and smart. But
Exactly.
people who don't
That is the
know,
moment.
you know, who've never had a conversation with a cheerleader, we are spokespeople, and the organization has to trust us to speak on their behalf. And I always say, like, I feel like there were so many instances where we were handed a microphone at, you know, if it was like a nonprofit event and all of a sudden you're speaking to 50 people and nobody told you that you were going to be doing that. And you had to, you know, it happens to put a smile on your face and just, you know, casually address all these people in the room. And like, trust me, I hate public speaking. So, but you can't be nervous because you're a performer. And you gotta just like shut it down.
That gave me a flashback to an event that I went to, very, very similar. I think you set the stage perfectly. Nonprofit. You could tell they were super, super excited to have somebody from the Seahawks organization there. Great, you know, all for it. I was the only one. And then they were like, "Would you like to come up and say a few words?" It was like some, thankfully, it was like a women's leadership kind of summit of some sorts. But did I have planned remarks? No. You know how like you'll be somewhere and you're kind of like in the background. You're not there to take attention away once kind of like the photo op is over with. So I was listening and engaged, but not really like completely clocking the program so far to know. That was a miracle. They raved about it, but I was winging it like nobody's business because it was definitely not planned. And you're trying to be engaging and not like a flat piece of toast. I don't know, piece of toast. That's not a flat pancake. That's what I was thinking of. But yeah, it was. But you could be put in those situations.
Want to put flat pizza toast either.
Oh my gosh. But yeah, you could totally be thrust into certain situations where you're having to woman up and capture the audience and be endearing and make them want to call you back and say, "Oh my gosh, that was amazing. Please come back next year," or whatever. So
I feel like that's why there's so much overlap between actors and NFL or NBA cheerleaders as well, because you really do have to act. Like you have to turn on the charm. It doesn't matter if you had 3 hours of sleep the night before. It doesn't matter if you were at a brutal 9-hour workday. Like you have to act excited to be there. And often you were, but you know, there's so many other factors going on in the background. And to be able to turn on that charm like that and be pleasant and friendly and make people feel warm and welcome, like that's a talent in itself, on top of all the dance talent and the fitness and all of that.
yeah, so true. Like I even felt like when I stopped dancing for a while, like I joked that I'm like the greeter a gap because it's just ingrained in like how you make every single person that you come into contact with at an appearance or otherwise, like each interaction is special and you make them feel something. I don't know. And I still feel like at times that I carry that with me where it's just, that's how I connect with people right away. Eye contact, like I need to cut it out sometimes because it's kind of like you're not working, you're not on. But it's a skill set. I mean, because you do have to snap into it, leave everything at the door, and come across genuine too. Because I mean, you could fake it, but you don't want to be that person either. Like being the fake, endearing, oh, you know, whatever. That's annoying. You don't want to be that person.
Exactly.
But you said like a lot of what I would think, especially the Rams organization looked for. I met Keely at ProAction, but she was just talking about like how heavily the interview portion is weighed in their auditions process because they take that very, very seriously. And I just thought that was good for her to kind of communicate that because people tend to think the interviews are important, but not like that important. Would you say the interview process was kind of like, we're looking for that person who's able to be that spokesperson for the organization?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say coach, but I always like speak to a couple people a year who are auditioning, you know, as most alumni do. And I still tell them to this day, I'm like, I'm not a part of the organization anymore. And I don't know if the ideals have changed. However, you have to nail that interview because that's where they get to see who you are as a human being. And, you know, you don't have to be perfectly polished, but that's where they get to see your potential. You know, the dancing is the foundation. And especially in LA where we have so many commercial industry dancers, you get a ton of amazing dancers. It's never the technique that's the problem. And if the technique is the problem, you know, we have practice twice a week, sometimes more, there's room to work on that stuff. But if you don't have that natural like charm and personality for it, then you kind of just are a background dancer. And that's not what we ever were. We were always like, of course, we have those moments where we were in the background and we're, you know, cheering on and supporting the men on the field. But there are many, many moments where you are the center of attention, even if unintentionally. And you kind of, you know, that interview is just the place where they get to see, like, how are you going to answer like this random question that we throw on you? And if you mess up, how are you going to brush it off? Are you going to laugh at yourself? Are you going to get nervous and die inside? Maybe you can do both.
can we tell you died inside?
oh my gosh, I had a really embarrassing answer and I don't remember what the question was. Oh, I think it was something about like, what is your day-to-day routine or how would you prep for like a Rams event or something of that nature? And, I had just finished talking about how I had worked at DreamWorks Animation at the time. I was a TV publicist there. And the way that I normally describe DreamWorks to people, because they're always like, oh, Pixar? I'm like, no, it's different. They're like, oh, Inside Out? Oh, Monsters, Inc.? I'm like, no, the lesser known one, other one. And then to help them out, I would always say, we made Shrek. And so I always had that connection in my head. And they're asking me this question about prepping or something. And I somehow, and for some reason, said that I am not a morning person. And I look like, you know, I'm kind of like Fiona, but not when she's in her human form, when she's in her ogre form. And I'm not sure why I thought that was a good idea to say at an NFL cheerleading audition. That I like, why would I create that connection for them? Oh, Emily, the one who looks like an ogre. Oh my God. And I remember going home that night and I was like, oh no, I've absolutely watched it. This is the end of the line for me. I also laughed at myself.
I can't stop laughing meanwhile. No, but that's how you handled it at the time. Cause it's actually kind of cute and funny. Like nobody would actually think legit, like you look like Fiona, but just the connection, I'm sorry. I would have been tickled. Like clearly I'm tickled, but
I just imagine that us walking out of the room. Cause it was it was a joint interview. I think there were three of us. So not only did I say it, but I said it in front of other candidates and I wanted to die.
Oh my gosh. But you know what? Even if you were the like the Shrek girl or the Fiona girl and talking, you know, as the judges talk about, you're memorable. Like sometimes you'll give nicknames to people to like things that make people stand out in your mind. And it's better to be noticed than not noticed, you know?
Yeah.
And you were stunning, I'm sure, during this interview, so you did not give off Fiona vibes. That is so cute and hilarious. But I would have died inside too, like, oh shit, what did I just say?
Ogres, are you kidding me?
Oh my goodness. So you make the team. What years were you cheering?
2017 to 2020.
Okay. So was that one of the Super Bowl appearances?
We went to a Super Bowl in, yes. It was my second year.
Got it. Okay. And that must have been like insane. That was in Atlanta, yeah?
Yeah. It was truly, like, to this day, one of the most surreal experiences of my life. Like, I don't think we slept, but every moment was just, okay, we're going to be on CNN this morning. And then, okay, now we're going to be on NBC. And now we're playing this Nickelodeon game show with all of these like pro footballers who they weren't obviously in the game that weekend, but just like starstruck to another level. And not only, you know, we weren't just like in their presence, but like we were up there with them in the talent too. And it is to this day one of the coolest things I've ever been a part of. But one fun behind the scenes story is that So the night before the game, we had this like friends and family cocktail hour. Everybody had been at different events and gigs all day. And half of us came to this little cocktail thing. We had some like shrimp cocktail, and then we wanted to go to bed to like, you know, get our beauty sleep, whatever. And that night, probably at like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, my stomach starts hurting. I'm like, that's weird. And it's like not the kind of stomach pain that you can just sleep off. And excuse the imagery, but like I ended up throwing up all night. And I woke up in the morning. The
shrimp cocktail was made you sick?
Well, wait. So I wake up in the morning. I'm still unwell. Like I feel like sometimes if you have food poisoning, you go through it and then you wake up the next day and you're fine. I was not fine in the morning. I was super dehydrated, I'm assuming. And so I start texting like a larger group, and other people had been throwing up. So we got connected.
Oh my God. Go ahead.
We got connected with the team doctor who was staying in the hotel to help the players. And he comes up, he like takes a look at us, and he's basically like, yeah, I don't think that this is food poisoning because only half the team went to that cocktail hour. The other half didn't eat whatever we ate. And many of them were also sick. And he goes, I'm fairly certain this is just a virus. And it seems to be pretty contagious. And sure enough, my roommate, who had been fine the night before, then started throwing up the morning of the Super Bowl.
Oh my gosh.
And we finally like get ourselves out of bed. I remember texting our coach and saying, I'm severely unwell. I'm just not going to do my makeup because I want to stay in bed as long as I can and like save myself. And we got on the bus. There's photographers everywhere. So we're like, you know, hair in front of our faces, like, don't look at me. And there were barf bags on the bus. And I don't think that anybody used them, but like, I just have a bunch of selfies with the barf bag, like, haha, why am I sick on the day of the Super Bowl? Most of us ended up pulling it together. We just were like pure adrenaline, like, you are going out there no matter what. You are not missing this moment.
We're not going to puke on the Super Bowl.
I was like, I'm not looking back on this day when I'm a grandma and telling my grandkids that I missed it because I had some stomach flu. Like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah,
pulled it together, but because it was like those contagious, some people started getting it like halfway through the game, and during halftime, we all had to have a little chat. Like, okay, I know you guys really want to be out there; you don't want to miss this moment, but we're looking a little low energy. So, if you are sick, you know, you need to come off and just take care of yourself and rest. And of course, we're all stubborn and we're dancers and we're competitive. Like, I'm fine. So that was just an incredible little you know, story behind the story.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That is perfect. This is the last season of the podcast, and I don't know how I got away from having the, what do we used to call it? Locker room. God dang it. It used to be called something where we would share like little secret behind the scenes, Brittany and I. These are the stories that are the best, that unless you kind of like are talking about it and really reminiscing, you'll totally forget. That is crazy. But I would have been the same thing. Like, buckle up. I'm going to just pull it together and I'm just going to dance. But it's hard when you have a stomach flu. Like, that weakens your whole entire core. Like, when I had it earlier in the year, I felt like I could not get out of the bed. Like, there was just no energy at all to do anything. Yeah. I can't imagine feeling that way on the day of the Super Bowl. Oh my God.
Like, you do not miss the Super Bowl because you do not know if you will ever have that opportunity again. You're like, I want to be out there with my teammates. We've worked so hard for this. I am not missing this moment. But it also just is kind of perfectly representative of the sort of bond that you have with your teammates because, yeah. You know, it's like all of these little behind the scenes moments where there's, you know, there's this perfect picture and you're smiling up at the crowd at the Super Bowl and there's all these lights behind you and it's this fabulous moment. But in reality, like, I can't look at those pictures without like cracking up because I know that I was like trying not to vomit on the field. And, you know, we all had each other there, like pumping each other up in the locker room, like, you got this, you are going to go out there and you are going to kill it. And you're going to perform your butt off and it's going to be amazing. Classic.
Thank goodness that nobody yacked on the Super Bowl stage. Or just, cause like I said, it could be so debilitating. It could be coming out of both ends for crying out loud. That's too easy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, some of them are really ruthless with on your body. So cheers to y'all for getting through that. Like, craziness. I'm sure the director probably was trying to give everybody the benefit of the doubt of just not saying you can't cheer, because that would have been heartbreaking and crushing. Yeah. But we're also trying to like weigh, you know, like, I'm not forcing you all to be out there. Like, if you really don't feel well, don't feel like you have to, but soldering up to get through it and, you know, having each other. Those are the times where you make the craziest jokes, like anything to get you through it. You know what I mean?
I'm just like, second, if we would have like a sideline cheer and the second we would turn around and put our palms behind our back, it'd be like, how you feeling? You feeling okay over there? You're like, I'm struggling, but I'm smiling. Yeah. You know, like those little conversations. So good.
Oh my goodness. Well, now I have to ask, because now you're making me all nostalgic. Do you miss it?
Of course I miss it. Of course I do. It's hard because I write about this field now, but every couple of months I have an itch. I'm like, should I go try out for like the Brooklyn Nets, or like, I've never done NBA before. I know. But then I'm like, oh, I feel kind of old and like, I don't know if I'm in shape for that, or even like ethically, if I would be able to do that and write about it, probably not. Write about it. Oh, so, okay. You know, I'm lucky to be in New York where there are so many amazing classes, and I've been trying to, I've started taking Vogue classes, and hip hop and heels, like more heels classes than I've ever taken in my entire life. So okay. I think, you know, just trying to, it's definitely like filling a void. Like, cheerleading was such a huge piece of my life. And also like this really formative moment where I really defined for myself who I am as a teammate, but also as ultimately a writer, and figured out, you know, what I really value, and not just like generally in life, but in the workplace, which is what cheerleading is. It's another job. It's a really beautiful, fun, glamorous, and strenuous job, but it's a job.
Yeah. At
the end of the day.
Well, how did you make the transition of knowing that it was time to walk away from that job and to pursue your career in journalism?
Yeah, this is where we get a little more honest, I think. Not that I've been disingenuous.
You've been lying this whole time, Emily.
I think we've heard this narrative on your podcast before, but the first year, you are just starstruck at this opportunity. I can't believe they picked me. I can't believe I get the opportunity to do this. And it's just magic. And it is really hard to put into words. the second year, I feel like for me, and I'm sure for a lot of other people, is kind of about improvement. Like, okay, yes. Now I know what's going on here. I know the drill. And now I want to kind of perfect. I want to, you know, act as a leader to other rookies or other teammates. I want to set an example, kind of like perfecting and chiseling away at yourself. Like, how do I be the best teammate on this team?
Well, they also expect that of you too, right? It's like, you can't come in as you were as a rookie. You have to show this, you know, the shift and improvement, and that you aren't taking it for granted. And you kind of are supposed to show up as this super improved version of yourself from a rookie, which is a lot of pressure to live up to, but definitely kind of the expectation.
Yeah. And you just kind of are showing them, like, I know that my spot on this team is not guaranteed. And yet here I am, mm-hmm. showing up, giving you everything for 2 weeks in this very gnarly audition process that really plays with your mental health. I don't know that we talk about that a lot. We talk about how auditioning is really difficult, but
not the mental health aspects. I agree.
The second and third year auditions, I was extremely in my head because now I had something to lose. I knew mm-hmm. how much I loved this team and this job and this opportunity. And if I didn't make it, you know, it was all of those what ifs. What if I get cut? You know, what if I am not improving quickly enough? What if I am not the best dancer in the room? And it starts to like really get into your head. And even the most mm-hmm. confident people who've been on the team 5, 6 years, even, you know, they start to ask those questions of themselves too. Like, you know, there's always like the young blood or the fresh meat. Like, what if I get edged out? But, and that happens. Like, that absolutely
does. Definitely does. But, and don't you think that when you're talking about that or those insecurities with your fellow teammates or vets, like, you know, you've that energy almost like multiplies because you all are in that same position. Maybe you're talking to your rookies, sisters, brothers, or whatever, and you're in that mindset of preparing for auditions and you're sharing all of those things like, what if this, what if that? It literally can just be this effect of everybody feeding off of one another in that way, in a negative way, frankly, because you're all scared shitless that you're going to lose your opportunity. And you're building each other up too, I'm sure. That's kind of what we do as friends and trying to dispel that a little bit. But it does start to like deteriorate your mind that you're worthy of that opportunity again. Like, you're stripping that all away as though you have to, I don't even know, some superhuman feat to actually show that you're worthy all over again. It's more pressure than you feel the first time, hands down.
Sure. And because you've seen it play out, like, you've seen people not make the team. And so you mm-hmm. don't really have the option to walk in like I had walked in at, you know, the USC Songgirls, where I was just blissfully unaware. You are painfully aware of what very well could happen to you and what it would mean to lose that and how you'd have to explain it to family and friends. So yeah, it's tough to get through those weeks. But yeah, so second year, all about improvement. The third year is for me when I started taking a more critical look at what I was doing. And I think, you know, the first 2 years I was just so excited to be there and it was never about the money. I had this paycheck and I was very lucky to be employed full-time as well. So for me, it was kind of like, I saw that as like, okay, I'm going to reinvest this into like hair stuff and nail stuff and spray tan.
Yes, money.
Exactly. Like reinvesting it into that dance career so that I could feel as strong and confident as possible. Or, you know, buying a little Rams t-shirt or some cute paraphernalia.
There we go.
The most long and complicated word I could have picked. So yeah, I just started kind of asking questions like quietly or amongst friends outside of the field, you know, why do we make so little? We give so much of our time and energy to these organizations. And I think a good comparison to draw is like, you know, let's say we're talking about an industry dancer who's going on all these auditions, whether that's for commercials or TV shows, music videos, whatever. Those are gigs. Those are often one-off jobs. Maybe there's a follow-up opportunity. And, you know, of course, little mini families are being kind of bonded together in those moments too. But being a cheerleader is not a gig. We go and do individual gigs, but this becomes like a whole persona. It is like this kind of other identity that you develop. And for many of us, it becomes, you know, your full identity. It's the coolest thing that you do and the coolest thing to be a part of. And when people talk to you in your social life, they're like, oh, you cheer for the Rams. That is so cool. And obviously there's a lot more to it than just like social notoriety, but literally the number of hours worked, but also the preparation that went into that, whether that was from a beauty and physical perspective, a fitness perspective, prepping for interviews, prepping for games. If we learned a routine last minute, or we found out on a Friday night that actually we would be performing a halftime with the musical artist, then the next, you know, 36 hours are extreme stress trying to make sure that you're not the one that messes up. To me, it was all of the outside hours that we were putting in. And of course, we are putting them in because we love it and because we're passionate and because we're so grateful for the opportunity. However, we need to be paid in a way that reflects the value and the quality of work that we do. And like right. I said, it is work, even if we don't see it that way. That's kind of, not to get all like, I hate capitalism, but that is what, that is what capitalism is. We work and we make money, and it is our job and it is within our rights to advocate to make more money if we think that we deserve it. And I absolutely thought that we deserved more.
It is interesting that you would talk kind of about each year and just the thought process, where you're at mentally in looking at the opportunity, because you're weighing so many things. Where does this fit into my life as a whole outside of this? Because you don't really get to have much of a life outside of it. And so you're definitely evaluating the time that you're investing in doing it, as much as you love it and you appreciate each opportunity that you go through, all those auditions, and you make the team, you want the opportunity and you work hard for it. But it is interesting, like at a certain point, like 3 year and beyond, if you're just at least thinking critically about these things, where you're kind of like having to assess whether it's because you are missing out on professional opportunities with your 9 to 5 because of how much time that you need to invest in being an NFL cheerleader or dancer or whatever. And I just think it's almost like it's inevitable that you go through this thought process. Like, is it worth it? Where you're having to like weigh the pros and cons of the investment, because there's so many hours, like you said, outside of what you're actually compensated for, that you're having to put into it to actually be successful as a teammate. And so it takes a while for that to sink in. And it's just really interesting to hear kind of like the year by year update as to where you're at with it. I had a number locked in my head of how many I wanted to do, because my lucky number is really silly, what 5 years meant to me. But I think you're kind of right. It's kind of like after year 3 or so that you're like, okay, if I'm doing this, or you really have to go through this huge analysis leading up to auditions, like all the pros and cons, what you're giving up, you know, all the things that go into making the decision that this commitment is worth it to you beyond just whatever, the fame, the notoriety, because it's not the money ever. It's really all the other things. And it's like, is that enough or not? And did you think that your career in any way was impacted by your time commitment with the Rams, or was it, you know, manageable?
I think at that time I was a little checked out because I was still working in publicity. And so actually I looked forward to getting to kind of jump into a different version of myself after work, where I could forget about the day and like be excited to learn choreography from these amazing choreographers that I idolize. And, you know, getting paid was just like the added bonus. I think ultimately it was two things. It was, I wanted to figure out what the next step in my career was going to be. So it wasn't necessarily that I was missing out on opportunities, but I knew I needed to kind of focus a little bit more before adding more things back in. And the bigger one is that, you know, when you represent these organizations, you kind of are attaching yourself to the brand and vice versa, and the values that they promote. And I think when you are on a team, you know, so many people start off really young. starting off at 18, yes. starting off at 21. Mm-hmm. I was a bit later in the game. I think I was 24 or 25 when I made the team. But even so, like mid to late 20s, you are a different person by the end of your 20s. And I think I was really growing up as I was on the team, and all of these sorts of different things kind of started to pop up for me. And as much as I loved cheerleading and I loved dancing, I just didn't feel that I could be a part of it anymore. I thought that there was a different way that I could contribute to the industry.
Well, that's fair. You know, like when you're thinking about compensation, not that that's the main reason to walk away from this, you know, the pay going in, you have to understand your why, I think, prior to, or figuring it out once you make the team, kind of what your why is. But it's just a good amount of like self-reflection that I'm hearing of like, how does this experience or how does representing this team kind of align with where I'm at in my life and what I feel like I'm about? And, you know, being willing to detach yourself from that persona, because that attachment really can be detrimental, I think, for mental health purposes, when people have attached themselves so much to representing the organization that they get lost in it and they forget who they are, or they struggle with who they are once the organization says, I'm done with you, I'm sorry, you can cut, or whatever it might be. Kind of making the decision for yourself as to like, I need to evaluate this. Like, does this fit? Does this match or map to what I'm trying to do with my future? Blah, blah, blah. It's just a very mature mindset. And I think when you have people joining teams that's so young, like you said, 18, 19, 20, you know, you haven't had enough life experience potentially yet to really be able to ask yourself these questions and kind of go through that thought process. And so to some extent, I think the organizations benefit from that, like the naive, like star, you know, studded, what's the word I'm looking for? Okay, maybe I should not drink rosé during my interviews. Oh, nice. But like they're taking advantage of that stargazing, like, this is also new and also cool and so great that I'm just not questioning like anything.
The rose-colored glasses.
There we go. Not rosé-colored glasses, everyone. Rose.
I would prefer those.
But yeah, timing-wise, though, this was also right around when the freaking Rona hit too, right? Were you on the team the year of the Rona?
No, I had retired the year before.
Got it. Okay. So then did you make the decision, okay, my NFL career, I want to contribute, like you said, to the industry in a different way. Like, what led you to apply to the master's program at NYU?
Okay. So I was working as a publicist at an entertainment agency, and I actually got furloughed when COVID hit because so much of our work was doing events and, you know, like promoting those events and going in person and managing talent, and none of that was happening. And so unfortunately, the owner had to make the really tough decision to furlough all of us. And as many cheerleader dancer types are, I did not know how to sit still. I really freaked out. I was like, oh my God, every second of my day has been scheduled since I was in middle school. You know, it's like the AP classes and the college stuff. And then I have dance and then I have competitions over the weekend. It's like, I didn't know how to be still. And all of a sudden I went from having two jobs to none. And I was collecting unemployment, which was also a very kind of surreal feeling of like, wow, I actually cannot provide for myself right now. And I had a lot of time to think. I was meditating and doing yoga and really kind of spending time alone with myself to get back in touch with what I really love. And, you know, not to pretend that that was a great time in my life. I was very depressed. I got on antidepressants at that time, not to toxic positivity my way out of that one. But I do think that that was a really important part of my growth, that it's okay to ask for help. And in asking for help, you get clarity because you can free up some of that space in your head that's devoted to anxiety and worst case scenario, which is totally fair in a pandemic. That is okay to
be. Yes. Yes.
But it wasn't until I got help that I sort of had the mental clarity, you know, to really investigate, like, if I could start over, which I essentially can, what would I want to do with my life? And I had always known this answer, and that answer is to write. I didn't know how it would manifest. I was looking into you know, creative writing nonfiction programs. I was looking into MFAs, which is a fiction degree. And ultimately I landed on journalism because after going through this experience, this life-changing experience as a cheerleader, I had some things to say. And I also saw a gap in the media coverage that many of us have experienced, that feeling of being written about and being misunderstood, the feeling of not being written about at all, or the feeling of taking the hyper negatives or the hyper positives and nothing in between. So I don't know, I felt really strongly that there was this opportunity for me to both criticize the industry as a means to make it better, but also to uplift the voices and the people that are in it that are actively making it better. And hopefully to do that with what we call beautiful prose, which is kind of just like, you know, the way that you write, doing so in a way that felt like art. Like I wanted it to feel like art, not just like, this is Sally and she's a cheerleader and she is a talented athlete, you know?
Yeah.
It felt like it did more depth than that. So yeah.
And that's what your article about Lindsay's felt like to me when I was reading it. It was art. It was so poetic in describing Lindsay's role in this world and just describing her in general and how awesome she was. I was just like, this is like the best freaking article I read in so long. And it was art. And so, I mean, you are a very, very talented writer. And I love how freely you're able to write with like just all of your attitude's not the right, maybe it is the right word. It's just your personality is infused in it in all the right ways. You could just hear the freedom in the way that you're able to express yourself, which is so freeing, I think, in general. I'm sure there's editors, but like you're saying what you want to say for the most part, how you want to say it, definitely not as controlled as it would be as a spokesperson for a team, which I know is can be limiting. I mean, we probably are kindred spirits in that way. There's no way I could have said half the stuff I said for this podcast or on an NFL team. I would have been absolutely canned. But, you know, having that freedom to talk about this space, like you said, in a way that maybe a critique, but with the right mindset, like at least I've lived it. I know it firsthand and I want to see it better for everybody kind of lens, as opposed to I'm an outsider and I don't necessarily appreciate all the nuances and I'm just going to like tear it to shreds and not recognize anything good about it. I mean, it definitely, like you said, it was an opportunity to provide another voice. And there was so much stuff going on around that time too, to write about. Like, talk us through like some of your experiences and kind of like what kickstarted, because I feel like it's just been like a snowball, like you've just been writing more and more and more in different topics, but like talk us through your career progression as a journalist.
Yeah, it's one of those like double-edged sword things where I am only where I am right now because there is something to write about and talk about, and they're not necessarily great things in the industry. But I think, you know, my first sort of like big opportunity to say something was during COVID. And I thought it was extremely irresponsible and unacceptable that many teams in the league were not testing their dancers. And I know there are some, you know, more nuanced kind of legal implications there of, you know, sometimes they're contractors, sometimes they're part-time, and that kind of stipulates what, you know, access to healthcare or benefits that they get. I am aware, but these people are still showing up to practice, to perform, to gather in person in the middle of a pandemic on behalf of your brand. And the biggest disparity to me was that some of the teams were providing multiple COVID tests a day for front office staff and for the coaches and players. And as we know,
for us.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know there was an argument made that, you know, the cheerleaders at the time, they were not allowed on the field, but they were kind of up on like the parapet and there weren't any fans. So, you know, it was a relatively safe environment, but why would you not want to protect your people? You know, it's all just, you know, and there were all of these kind of, it was still in the beginning of COVID. So we didn't really have a good understanding of exactly how it spread and how long like the incubation period was and when you would start being symptomatic or spreading it. So it just felt like this one step that the teams could have gone to ensure that they are keeping their people safe. Like, if you are going to show up for us as a cheerleader during this really dangerous, unprecedented times, I'm using finger quotes because that word was so overused.
Oh my gosh.
But the least that the teams can do with their $1 billion, which of course are not always funds that are accessible at all times. However, $1 billion organizations, we can scrape together some money. That was really what set me off of, like, I know that there are so many people in the league that either wouldn't want to say anything because they wouldn't want to endanger their spot, you know, or needed the money and didn't want to risk losing that, you know, small source of income, or just wanted to show up because their lives had shut down and they had this one thing that they still were able to do. Of course, yeah. Nobody was being forced to be there against their will. I want to make that 100% clear. I also want to be clear that I personally don't fault any of the directors, and specifically my former director, for what was happening at that time. Because as we know, so many of these directors don't have much power or leeway within these organizations. They're kind of at the whims of, like, whatever the execs decide. Here's your budget. Here's what you have this year. Make do. Sorry, we don't have budget for tests for the cheerleaders. So of course, there's so many factors at play, but the optics were really bad and nobody was writing about it. Not one person asked, like, what are they doing for the cheerleaders? And that to me said even more about the culture. And even just from a media perspective, that nobody had even bothered to ask. So I know that there are varying opinions about what was considered safe at the time. But from my opinion, because I was outside of the league at this time, I could make as much noise as I wanted to. To me, the safety and well-being and health of those men and women and people and teammates that I care so deeply about is number one. So if I see something that is not up to par, I'm going to say something. And that was the first time that I really had been honest publicly about what I did and didn't like about NFL cheerleading.
And then I feel like it just kept on going, like you said, with all of the awesome stories that were coming out. Not stories. It just seemed like it was in, like, avalanche of just thing after thing after thing that would happen in the NFL cheerleading space specifically, where it was just kind of like, here we go again, having to address some more crap that's going on in our space. Even I felt this, I'll just speak for myself with a podcast. I just feel like for 6 months, probably I was just ranting for every time I turned around. Like, I wanted to get on and be like, yay, what's going on in our space? Like, let's talk about other stuff. And something would happen. And then it would just, like, how can you not address it? You had to speak up and say something. But I almost had to check myself, like, am I just kind of doing what the outside journalists do, where they pick up on a negative headline and then they're just drilling it and talking about it to pounding it into the earth versus saying something or having it be more balanced and offset? Did you struggle with that a little bit in writing about some of the stuff that was going on at the time?
Yeah, because historically, the way that NFL cheerleading in particular has been written about, and NBA teams too, because they've gone through many closures, sudden unexpected closures of their teams. You know, I was aware that there is a negativity bias. People like to click and read and talk about scandals. And it's also, you know, like, it is very easy to make those sort of salacious events also look like big journalistic moments of, like, look what we've uncovered. And not to diminish that work, because sometimes it is necessary. But I did have to constantly ask myself, like, am I only being attracted to the negative things and the things that are wrong? And that's why, like, the Lindsay piece in particular, which was for Teen Vogue, was so important to me, because it really centered on joy, which is not something that typically is centered in journalistic writing, at least not about NFL cheerleaders.
No.
And the part about that piece that I was really excited about is something that used to come up in media interviews when I was a cheerleader. And something that we would prep for is, like, when people ask you, like, are you uncomfortable in your two-piece uniform? And we would so quickly say, no, I'm not. It wasn't an act. It wasn't a lie. We felt like superheroes, you know, we get to put on this beautiful blinged out, you know, the little skirt, the pleated skirt and the shoulders with the ram's head, like beautiful. Yes. And you get to know like all of these women who came before you have worn the same thing and you kind of get to step into their shoes. So when we answered that question in interviews, we would always say, of course, I feel empowered. I feel beautiful. And we did. And so I was really interested in teasing out that idea of like sexiness, because what started as, and I'll just quickly say, Sarah Heppala, who is a journalist and writer and now mentor of mine, made a podcast about the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders called America's Girls.
That was so good. I was so good. Into that every week. Like if people have not, just check it out. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but America's Girls was really, really well done. Go ahead. Sorry. Like Sarah a lot. Yes.
She did a really good job of investigating, you know, the beginnings of NFL cheerleading and how it started actually very like, you know, covered up and
modest.
And then the branding became sexy very intentionally. And yet for the later generations, like you and I, that sexy branding then, you know, flipped on its head and became a negative thing for us, that we were kind of literally like had this like scarlet letter on our chest of like, I'm a cheerleader and I am sexy, but you're not allowed to perceive me and you're not allowed to tell me I'm sexy, but I feel sexy and I can say it about myself. Like it became just this really tension filled, you know, even mental conversation about, are we sexy or are we not? Can we feel sexy and not, you know, tell the world that we feel that way? It was just very confusing. And so that piece with Lindsay was about that question of like, are cheerleaders really allowed to be sexy? And with her taking photos of us, we could be, because it was from the quote unquote, like woman's gaze. Like she was able to capture us being confident and sexy and empowered without making it about sex. It wasn't about being objectified or the way that we were being consumed by a certain audience, cough, cough, men. It was about how beautiful we could be. And that wasn't just a physical beauty. It was something else. It was passion. It was talent. It was athleticism. And she captured it so effortlessly. And from my perspective, that was a way that we could communicate to the outside world that we aren't objects. And here's somebody who knows how to capture us as the multifaceted people that we are. And also Lindsay freaking Rosenberg is just one of the most beautiful human beings. Don't say that lately. So I was very, very lucky that she let me into her life. This person that she had photographed one time.
She's so like ninja about it. Like she's so like modest. It's not even the word for her. I look up to her in so many different ways. And I just think she has impacted this space in a way where when I look at any photo gallery for different teams, like she has influenced how cheerleaders are photographed by their own photographers. But yeah, your piece on her though did her so much justice. Like if I had the task, I'm doing a terrible job now of trying to describe what she means and how amazing she is, but you just captured it so perfectly. And I was like hooked on your writing ever since. What's your favorite article that you've written about?
I have two. I have three. No, I'll just keep it to two. The LSU Tiger Girls. I wrote a sort of investigative feature about the LSU Tiger Girls. They went viral because their administration blocked them from competing at UDA. And they came back, I think, technically 2 years later from the last time they had performed and won their division. And it was the most beautiful, triumphant sports story, because it is a sports story. Which Tribe 99, I don't know if you guys are familiar with them, but they it was Sammy McFadden and Carson Rowe that choreographed this routine that just perfectly encapsulated the fight and the horrible times that these women had overcome to get to that stage and win. And there were all of these moments of little like pelvic thrusts and like stank faces and these sort of like very masculine postures that were worked in throughout the routine. And yet they looked so natural on the dancers. Because, I mean, the message is so clear, like, you can tell us that you're not going to give us, you know, funding to do what we do best and what we are most proud of. However, we can still dance as or perform as what you think is like a boy, which is strong, steadfast, competitive. So that was a really amazing experience. And I got to talk to a bunch of the dancers, choreographers, directors who were a part of that. And it was wild to see a larger community than just the dance community understand like what a breathtaking moment it was and what they were really going through. Dance teams across the country are extremely underfunded. And we always say, if we look at this like a totem pole of, you know, the money-making sports, which by it, I think you might know this better than me, but through Title IX, we are not supposed to value one sort of sport over the other because of the money that they bring in. The existence of sports in universities and in education is to advance these ideals of hard work and teamwork and, you know, just advancing towards a common goal. It was never supposed to be about money, except it is. So there was money-making sports, which is football, basketball, and then there were, well, those were men's football and basketball. And then women's basketball, maybe they're underneath baseball, maybe underneath soccer. Then all the Olympic sports, and then maybe at the bottom, dance or cheer.
So if they were even considered a sport, because they may not have been recognized as a sport.
That story felt like the really exciting beginning of this movement that's taking place amongst Gen Z dancers and on college campuses, which is, these teammates are starting to look at their organizations, ask questions about, why are we under the marketing department? Why aren't we under athletics? Why does that student athlete get priority registration and I don't, even though I rehearse 5 to 6 times a week? Why does that athlete get access to athletic trainers and nutritionists and private exercise facilities? And I have to use the student rec center with the rest of the student population, and maybe I can't even get on a treadmill. When I was in school, we didn't ask those questions. It just was how it was. And this new generation of dancers and cheerleaders are not accepting pennies anymore. That doesn't even have to mean literal payment. Like, you know, they're actually taking stock of what they have and what other athletes have and asking, when you look at us, what is the reason that we have less? And that is gender discrimination that is still very much alive and well in sport today. I think being aware that this movement is happening, it gives
it's
me
exciting.
It is. It's so exciting. Yeah. It gives me so much hope that, you know, if I become a parent someday, that my kid, you know, if they want to do dance, I won't force it on them. I promise.
Yes.
If they want to do dance, they will grow up in a better environment than I did, and they will have a better opportunity to take care of their bodies, which is their instrument, so that they can dance longer. So the shelf life doesn't have to be, you know, you have until you're 30 years old because your back's messed up because you never learned recovery or you never learned cross training. So yeah, I don't know. That was just the coolest experience. And I'm so proud of those teammates. And I feel like I'm like, I'm your biggest fan. They're like,
yes. Yeah, that was huge. And I was so pleased to see how much, like you said, outside of this cheer world, because I feel like sometimes we're like preaching to the choir. We all get it. We know, we care, we're passionate, but it's always nice when it's picked up on with a larger audience. And it's just spreading that awareness where they actually get it and seem to grasp, like to be able to ask those questions too. Well, yeah, I never thought about it, but why not? And so I just think this is how change happens. And that was a big one. What else came to mind? What was the second one?
The second one is a feature that I just put out a couple weeks ago. And it was about basically women's sports media, which is sort of this like changing, evolving landscape. And I bring this up because a lot of the way that sports were women's sports, and when I say women's sports, I mean anyone who isn't a man, the way that they are covered has a lot to do with how we value those women in sport. And that ties into this conversation that we've been having about cheer and dance, which is that we actually don't value those activities as sports. And so in this larger media landscape, they don't get covered. Like going back to what we were saying about scandals, they get covered as these sort of like accessory, ancillary scandals happening around these players that we care about. It's kind of like distraction, and sometimes it has to do with the owners. Sometimes it has to do with executives. It's kind of like, that's the reason that we care, is the connection to these larger teams and these cultures, like these masculinity field cultures that we really care about. And we don't get covered like sports. Nobody's saying, oh, here's the choreographers that they're working with. Here are the different tricks that they can do. Here are the ways that they're training. Nobody's talking to us for a post-game interview. Nobody wants to talk to us to ask how our performance went or what we messed up on or how we're going to improve for next time. There is no recognition of that athleticism and what we go through to learn these routines. Like even in learning choreography, we're flexing our memory muscles. And that itself is training that is unique to dance, right? So it just has made me really think about the way that dance and cheer might be covered in the future, where, you know, kind of like what you've
seen. Get me excited, girl. Get me excited. Right?
A little bit of what you've seen at UDA when it's on ESPN2 in the middle of the night. Not live coverage, but long after it actually happens, it finally airs. How you get those post-performance quick bite interviews of like, how did that feel? You know, which moments did you feel like you were killing it? Like that to me gives us a little window of what the future might be like, where you are valued as a human being and as an athlete and as an individual, and not just sort of this like paper doll in the background.
Yeah, I'm over that kind of either lack of coverage or type of coverage too. And it's people in our space like you and like Paige, and not just because you guys are women and are awesome, but it's just like a different lens of viewing this as a sport. And I just think if you lack the ability, and this is me thinking of conversations that I've had over the years, being on like a sports radio show where I kind of tried to hand it to somebody in Orlando who was talking crap about the Orlando Magic dancers going away, and they were just there to titillate and whatever the heck he was talking. And I woke my butt up at 4 a.m. just like, actually, if that's all you see when you see a performance, then there's something wrong with your eyes, because I see lines, I see synchronization, I just went off. And it's just the eyes of the beholder, right? And kind of like the respect to say that this actually takes, like, you could not get your behind out there and just do that. Like, it's no skill involved. Like, cut it out. Like, it's not that kind of party. Like, let me ask you this. Do you think in terms of coverage from a media perspective of sports like cheer and dance, like, do you think it starts with respect for the sport or the respect for the athletes that are participating in the sport? Not all women now. Obviously, there's men in our league as well. But where do you think is kind of like the actual trigger to getting the respect that this space deserves?
It's a little like the chicken and the egg question, but I think I think it actually comes down to the lack of respect for cheerleading and dance as sports is a symptom, I believe, of the lack of respect for women. I always say to people who think that I don't know if anyone thinks we've achieved gender equality in America, but I'm like, if you think that, I would like to direct you to the cheer and dance industries, where the pay disparity is so incredibly, that gap is so large. And I think that is because cheer and dance are seen as stereotypically feminine sports. They are literally attached to women, even though we know that collegiate cheerleaders actually started with men. And I think maybe Sarah Hebla can fact check me on this, but I believe NFL started
NFL with as well. The Colts. Yeah, they were co-ed, or actually not co-ed. They were male cheerleaders until the war. So right. Yeah, I mean, go ahead, keep going.
But,
yeah.
But because of very intense branding that happened with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders and becoming, you know, America's girls, the sexy bikini photo shoots, like that becomes overwhelmingly what we think of when we think about cheerleaders. The other part of that is even high school cheerleaders and college cheerleaders, we see them on sidelines, right? Like a fan is coming to a game, they see them maybe before the game at an event, and they see them on the sidelines. So they are literally accessories to the game. They're part of the game day experience, but they aren't the game. And when you see people as accessories on the sideline, as optional, there's all these questions of why don't we just do away with the cheerleaders? That's, again, a symptom of the way that we see women, which is that, well, this kind of athleticism, because it is so feminine and so associated with women, is girly, and it is less valuable than this kind of athleticism, which is masculine and strong and muscly or like bulging, like, right? Yeah. Like those are seen as two different things rather than just saying all of this is athleticism, all of this is sport, but it looks different.
Yeah.
And we always talk about, like, I would love to see a football player or a basketball player do what they do with a smile on their face, right? I would love to see you projecting out into the audience while doing what you do, right? Like, once people understand that, they're like, oh, shit, that sounds really hard.
Sometimes you think that, like, shows like Dancing with the Stars, where they get, like, the professional athletes, or maybe it has done a lot for dance, at least for them to appreciate dance in general, is not easy for just any old person to pick up, and that you get these, you know, talented actors and actresses and professional athletes and watch them struggle and grow and appreciate dance as a sport, because I don't think they value it in that way prior to participating in it. But I just think it's that mindset. It takes skill and it takes training and it's a sport. And I just can't wait for us to be like 50 yards down the 50 years down the road, 50 yards, 50 years down the road with that, where people actually, it's like the known given what it takes to actually be successful as a professional in cheer and dance. I definitely agree with your mindset, though, around it's kind of stemming from the lack of respect for women. And I'm curious to see, you know, as our spaces change over the last few years, if that picture changes now that the squad makeups are definitely different. The rosters for different teams are becoming increasingly co-ed, and it's just going to be interesting to see if that creates more of a shift of, like, now we'll recognize it as a sport or we'll appreciate it more. I don't know. We'll have to see. But I think the genesis of it all is very much tied to the lack of respect for women, and just gender equality in general does not exist quite yet in this space. And your body of work is just going to keep chipping away at that and drawing awareness to.
I'm extremely excited about the gender diversity that we're starting to see on squads. The Top Cats over at the Panthers are doing some incredible things. I am truly inspired by what some of their teammates are doing, because they are literally wearing, in many cases, the same uniforms, regardless of how much skin it shows. And I think that that's really powerful. And given that there's only one out football player in the entire league right now, the fact that we are infusing queer culture into the NFL through cheerleading is so cool to me.
It's pretty dope.
Like, that's fine if fans aren't ready to accept queerness on the teams. And I think that, you know, we'll start to see more and more out men joining the teams as we progress. However, you can't avoid it, because there it is on the sidelines. And guess what? It is beautiful to watch. That is something I'm really excited about. And also, I just want to be abundantly clear that I know I've been, you know, very vocal and opinionated and critical of this industry and these fields, but that is because I love it so much and I want it to be better. And I think a lot of people are able to slowly chip away at it from the inside out. But for me, I wasn't willing to wait. I wanted to start speaking on it now.
It's out of love. I've struggled with that too. I think in this space where I'm just like, people probably just think I'm like the angry, ranting person who only has something to say when it's negative. And look at what happens when you bring up negative stuff, like teams disappear and we're tired of that narrative. And I promise you, it's all coming from the space of we deserve better. I want to see more for everybody. Like, I'm cheering for everyone and I want to see everybody win and I want to see us respected. And I totally can relate to that because it's easy to feel like when you're putting yourself out there to be that voice that you can be misunderstood in that way. But I totally get it. It's for the love of our community. Like, and honestly, I say it all the time, but it's just like, if it weren't for people speaking up, whether it was lawsuits, whether it were articles, whether it was just using your voice, we would still be stuck a couple years back. We've made some drastic improvements, and I'm not trying to lay claim to anything. I just think overall, it's thankfully been through the awareness and spreading to really see that there are improvements that can be made in this space. And it's okay to ask those questions and to challenge the narratives that really don't serve us anymore. So keep doing what you're doing. I think it's fabulous. You are such a talented writer. Cannot handle it. Please continue to tag away in all your posts because I missed something here with the sports media. I'm going to have to dig that one up, but I want to link to all of your articles that you've written. I'd love for people to just become familiar with all of your work because you've written about so many different topics, not just the cheer stuff. So what's next for you? You just graduated. What are you about to be doing with yourself?
Yeah, I'm extremely grateful and feeling very, very lucky. So I'm a full-time staff writer at Jezebel. I started in November and it was just the most like affirming moment that I had actually gotten the call to interview for that job because of the COVID cheer article that I had written. Which was like,
oh my God,
the first big statement I had tried to make. And they saw value in that. And they saw that there was a topic there that wasn't being reported with nuance. Jezebel is a feminist online publication. And so I cover everything, which is namely sports, from a gender lens. And I think what they saw is that this conversation about gender and about, you know, women's rights is so baked into cheerleading and dance, and that it would be a really interesting time to hire a writer who focuses on that. So in the end, I got hired for being who I was and for caring about what I care about. And oh Lord, I was on a journey and a half to get to that place of knowing who I am and knowing what my purpose is. So for anyone who's listening, who is unsure of like, what is this crazy thing called life? And what am I supposed to be doing here? Like, just give it time as you continue to get to know yourself, it'll all become clear. So yeah, you can find my work there. And I post a lot on Instagram. All my stories I try to link to so people can find them.
Well, Emily, this was, like I said, so long overdue. I'm so thankful for your time. I'm just so happy that this brought us together because we care about so many of the same issues, concerns, that same fearlessness, but also like, be there for me a little bit because I'm a little nervous. Like, we get to talk, like our text threads and just being able to talk about things. But it's been such a pleasure developing our own not cyber friendship, but you know what I mean? Like, I feel like we've met and we are your best friends. Yes. But I'm thrilled to be able to just to see your face and to congratulate you in person-ish on all your accomplishments and just the way that you cover this sport with passion and heart, because that's just what we need. And I applaud all of your work. I'm super excited to just read every article. It's just juicy and just, I hear your voice and it brings me joy. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, cheers to you again. I think I have one last little swallow. Cheers to you. And cheers.
This is the last season or this is like, are you done?
This is the last season. I mean, I feel like, you know, sometimes it's just a struggle to get people to talk to, but like, you know, the mechanics of getting guests, well, it always falls into place, but the time that I would like to be giving to the podcast and all these amazing ideas that I have in my head that I don't get to execute fully on because of other demands, like, I just want to end on a high note versus just scraggling along. And I, you know, I feel like when I look at the space and over the last, it'll be 4 years in October. So it's kind of like, I feel like I've done my best to cover this space and I've seen changes that I love to see. And I feel like, not like I had anything to do with it, but just kind of like we're on the right path. And I think if I need to get up there and and rant one good time. If I need to, then I will. But I just feel like it's okay to step away and give time to some other things until this could have like more of my attention. Ideally, somebody will say, hello, I want to host the Spiritual Leading Podcast, and I can just be like, pass the torch, and then people can kind of run with it from there and, you know, just keep giving it life. We'll see what happens. You know how life is.
It's manifesting like, right now. I give it 6 months max, and I bet you somebody is going to reach out.
That would be great, because there's definitely openness to it continuing on without me at the helm. But it's been a beautiful journey, and I couldn't be prouder. And, you know, and it's something that I did not anticipate, but it's brought, you know, people into my life that I just couldn't imagine not of having the opportunity to know or to interview and just call friends in that kind of weird little friend way. But it's just people I care about. Shit, it's really interesting just how your heart expands for this community in a way where you're like, you really want to see people win and do well. And so,
yeah.
And I wouldn't say connected.
Still be there for the big moments, you know?
Absolutely. And hopefully creating new moments.
Started with community. You built a community of people who cared and were passionate. And now you're like taking it to the next level and moving into action, which is so.
Action. Yeah. Kind of was like, I'm over talking. It's about some action. And we'll see.
Yeah.
Let's see how it goes.
I just want to end on like my gratitude for NFL Cheer and the community and people, like even for bringing me to people like you and Lisa Guerrero, like superstars. But I wouldn't be who I am today without NFL cheerleading or without the Rams. And I am indebted to that organization and to all of the women who came before me because they all shaped me into who I am today. And now I get to help shape, hopefully, the next generation. So I'm forever a cheerleader at heart and will forever be part of my identity. And I will find any excuse to put on my white boots and grab my pom-poms and pretend I'm still doing it. And that's it.
No, okay. I definitely feel that.
Well, I'm so proud of you. Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Emily, take care.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to the Pro Cheerleading Podcast. You can follow your favorite podcast on social media at Pro Cheerleading Podcast on Instagram, at Pro Cheer Podcast on Twitter. We're on Facebook, on YouTube, and you can support your favorite podcast on Patreon. Until next time, keep your eyes on the sidelines.